So, Manisha, thank you very much for coming. It is greatly appreciated. Tell me where it all started.
Well, my love for football started really when I was a young child. I come from a sporty family, but see, the time that me and my twin brother were growing up, there were very few opportunities for girls to take part in football. And certainly if you were from, so, you know, I'm Indian, so certainly if you were from a community group that was that really, like, you know, let's say underrepresented, although certain terms that, you know, we don't like to use as such. But it, you know, that ultimately, it, you know, because I came from a sporting family, football was a big part of that. My dad was a huge Liverpool fan, and so were my uncles. My mum really enjoyed netball and athletics, football not so much, and she was more than happy for me to play at school, so that's pretty much what I did. And you know, me and my brother would play in the garden. And I remember when I was nine, so I played with my best friend Jenna for our school team. And Jenna also played for Barnet at the Centre of Excellence, which was my local girls' Centre of Excellence at the time. And there were trials, and you know, Jenna's mum asked my mum, "Oh, I think Manisha should go." So anyhow, she was my mum was more than happy for me to go. I went along with Jenna and her mum, and I got in. And you know, I had a great time, and I was really happy, obviously, that I'd got in. And then I thought, okay, now I'm going to have to go home and let my mum know that, you know, not only did I have a great time, but I've actually got in. So I did, and her reaction was very much, "That's great, but," and the "but" was more around, "I'm more than happy for you to play football, but the very fact that it was associated with school when I was playing for the school team was easy for her, because my brother also played for the school team. We would both be at the same venue. You know, it didn't require any extra and additional commitment." So that was pretty much that. But the most interesting thing, and at the time I didn't recognize this, because you know, as a nine-year-old, you're upset and you know, you're naive, and you pretty much just get on with life thereafter. So as much as I wanted to play for the team, as long as I could still play, I was fine. So you know, that's pretty much what I did. I went to secondary school, and again, there were very few opportunities for girls at that time. So I mean, look, this was, so I'll be 41. We'll be 41 this year. So women's football has only just started to develop and evolve. You know, it certainly didn't look like what it looks like now for when I was an 8 or 9 year old. And when I went to secondary school, very similar. You know, my PE teacher said to me that if you want a team, you need to go and find some girls who actually want to play. So it was just me and had another friend, Claire. We would be the only two playing football at the time. And I knew and understood that I wouldn't be able to play for a team, because there just weren't any teams for me to play for. And the few teams that there were on the weekend, for my mum, that required a lot of commitment, and it was difficult for her. You know, both my mum and dad did a couple of jobs just to keep us going. We lived in a big family house right at the beginning, particularly when they initially migrated from, say, from India to Kenya, from Kenya to England. You know, didn't have an education, left school when they were 12, 13. So pretty much were working very much straight away. So you know, education was a big part of our culture. And certainly when I say our culture, I mean like my family culture growing up. And a big part of that was also around the fact that they didn't have an education, and they had to do, you know, three, four jobs just to be able to survive and ensure that we had, you know, a great childhood, which we did have. And I started, when I was doing my GCSEs, I fell in love with child development, but I was also good at it, you know. So I thought, okay, well, I enjoy it, but it's also something that I'm quite good at. I remember this task that we were given. It was to look after an egg, and it was to make sure, basically, you had to treat it like it was a baby, you know, and make sure that the egg doesn't crack, because if the egg did crack, then, you know, it was all doom and gloom, because you didn't do too well looking after this young baby. And obviously I was good at looking after the egg, you know, just kept it on the side and didn't touch it. So that went well.
Good parenting. Good parenting.
Exactly. with my love for, you know, child development, then came a passion for maybe going into teaching. So that's kind of where I then went with understanding that football was never going to be in my pathway as a career, certainly not as a player anyway. And I actually didn't know that coaching existed either at that time. So I pretty much went into teaching. I did a BA in education with QTS, and I specialised in early childhood education. So PE or physical education still wasn't in my, let's say, in my pathway either, because even when I went in to become a primary school teacher, I hardly taught PE, funny enough. It was always my PPA cover. And the time that I did teach PE, the only education that I had when I was on my teaching practice, because I did the 3-year practice, was probably a couple of modules, which isn't a lot. And for somebody, you know, if you don't come from that specialist area, you're just all of a sudden having to think, okay, well, what am I going to do with 30 kids? You know, you've got apparatus, and although we don't probably use apparatus anymore, but at that time you did, you know. And even, you know, football and things like that, you're not equipped with how do you actually go about teaching this subject and managing the kids within the environment, because what I was used to was maths, English, science, you know, geography, history, and that type of thing, and being in a formal classroom setting. So that was what I was trained to do, and that was very much what I was used to. But within the duration of, as I just started my teaching degree, my twin brother also became really, really unwell, and unfortunately, due to a series of traumatic events at school, he was diagnosed with depression, and then he went into schizophrenia, and his condition was, well, so they said, and it's like the psychiatric doctors, it was unique because he was absolutely fine. So we had, you know, it's not hereditary. We don't have any, not to my brother's case anyway, you know, examples of mental health. So it was very new. So when it initially happened, we had absolutely no idea what it was. You know, it was very much, we were at Universal Studios in America for my brother's 18th, and all of a sudden he turned around and he was hallucinating, and he could see people with guns and all these things that were in his mind, that when we would turn around and we would think, well, hold on a minute, we can see are families, you know, people having a great time. So what he could see in his head, we couldn't see that. And this went on, and obviously we were away, so when we went back home, we didn't seek support. We kind of just thought, okay, let's just deal with it and manage it. My sister was also 5 at the time. There was a big age gap between us, and in terms of the reason for managing it, it goes back to similar when I spoke about, you know, the culturally, South Asians and football at that time, certainly, I mean, it's evolving now and there's conversations, but there were no conversations then. So, yeah. And that was no different to mental health and being South Asian, you know, and the taboo and stigma around what mental health is. So we pretty much just thought, let's just deal with it. And it was really tough because it, you know, like I said, his condition was really severe, that he had absolutely no awareness of who we were. He needed a real one-to-one care. He was violent. And it was to the point where it was the nature of his condition meant that he had to be sectioned. So we then recognized, okay, well, we actually can't, well, we weren't allowed to take care of him at home. Because, you know, it was a case of either causing harm to himself, know that several suicide attempts and he was kidnapped by his bullies, and I'm talking about extreme things where you would think, okay, you might see these things on TV or hear about it, but it's not going to happen to you. And I say it in a way that I do because it's so real in the respect of you actually do continue your life thinking that this will not happen to you or people that you know. And the moment it does, you actually are clueless on what to do. And that moment, so that was when we were 18, that pretty much changed my life completely, because I went through a period where I was really angry, and I'll be lying to say I'm not angry now. I'm just less angry, and I've learned how to channel that frustration. But it certainly molded me as a person, the way I view life, the way that I act and behave has certainly, it's been influenced by what's been going on at home, because although my brother lives with us now, you know, he only communicates with the voices that he hears, really. It might be in short statements. We might have a conversation, but he needs absolute one-to-one care. And this is from a boy who, say, was normal, you know, absolutely fine. So you're now, you know, to go from that to something that's completely different, completely changes everyone's lives. And I made a commitment to my family, you know, which was that I would just remain committed to what needs to be done. But as part of that, and I talk about frustrations and your own kind of, you know, when you think about your own mental health and your own well-being and what's also good for you, is I became so, I guess, inward on what was going on at home that my only channel became work. And I suppose that's why I did, I became a senior leader in teaching very early. Like I was a former deputy head. I can't say that I could have the title as a head teacher, because I never was a head teacher. I was doing my trainee headship. So I did my national professional qualification for headship, and I completed and passed my trainee, you know, my traineeship, but took a career change at that point, purely because, look, I was in a very challenging school at that time. It was the first time I ever experienced any racism in the 10 years that I worked across different schools. And I was also trying to finish my master's at the same time. And it was also the time where my mum had a triple heart bypass and she was in hospital. So I just felt that there was a lot going on. And my sister moved out to go to university. So wow. I just thought, okay, there's too much going on here. And I don't think I was in a right headspace either. So I thought, let me take a term out. But what happened was, in the 10 years that I worked in various schools, I was still passionate and had this passion and love for football. I think what I needed was something to ignite that again. Because when my brother became unwell, I didn't really want any associations with things that would remind me of things that we used to do. And looking back now, I understand that actually that was probably not a good strategy. And that's why, I guess, you know, like my advocacy and passion around mental health, particularly with children, and when I went in to become a primary school teacher, was really important, because I was in it from not necessarily, let's say, in some respect myself, with how you manage your emotions when you're going through this emotional roller coaster, how you manage adversities, you know, becoming resilient. And you know, trying to have a growth mindset. So mental health definitely for me in that regard. But also, what it was like, you know, all of a sudden becoming a young carer along with my family, and seeing, you know, somebody with schizophrenia firsthand, and those experiences. So that, I suppose, inspired me to want to do more work within that space. Yeah. And then it influenced things later, because, you know, the fact that, look, I'm at a professional football club now was purely come from, I guess, some of my earlier influences. Because had I not, I suppose, reignited my passion for football, I wouldn't have gone out in the playground, or I wouldn't have actually had a conversation with my head teacher at the time to say, look, we currently don't have an after-school club. I don't have a coaching badge, but, you know, I can teach and I can go on YouTube. Are you more than happy for me to take a group? And it was pretty much went from there. And it was only in 2008 that in the school that I happened to work in neighboured Wembley Stadium. So we linked in with Wembley Learning Zone. And because Rachel Yankee did a lot of work in Brent, she was coming into the school. So she spoke to me and she knew that I was working with the kids doing after school clubs and said, you know, oh, you do know that you can go and get coaching badges. So it kind of went from there. I did my level one while I was still teaching and then worked with her grassroots football club on the weekend, did my level two. And then when I took the actual career change, really, it was, again, we talk about, you know, like a network, like you've got a network here. What I was able to do was to tap into the network that I had created, be it few, but you know, and small, but kind of tap into people in grassroots organizations to see if there was something, I don't know, just there was obviously a pull to walk for me towards, okay, I think that I could probably do something in football. And a lot of that pull also came from my brother, the fact that I knew that, you know, he loves sport. And there'll be things that he may not ever be able to do and achieve. And you know, for me to be able to say, not achieve his dreams as such, because it is about, you know, things that I want to do. But yeah, you know, also look at things that he would have wanted to do in life. And and from then on, I pretty much made a decision in 2011 that whatever happens, I'll try and make this work. And, you know, I was lucky to have a really supportive family because I took a drastic pay cut, you know, but what I recognized was, and this is where, you know, I think in terms of education and when you're working with young people, that it's important for me to also, when you're talking to young people, to say that actually having a versatile skill set will go a long way. Yeah. Because I was able to sign up with supply agencies and do one-to-one tuition, which allowed me some income. And that income allowed me to trial and test other things. And then having the network allowed me to tap into people's knowledge and skills, you know, and volunteer. And I spent a lot of time, and I still do, you know, in grassroots organisations, like, you know, lucky that I've got Chris Ramsey, who's very supportive. So we're hopefully trying again, but with the Maccabee under 18 girls to take them to the Maccabee World Games next year. It fell through last year because of COVID.
Yeah.
Again, volunteering, you know, and working with them. So it pretty much, look, like I said, that I think where I am now, be it with QPR, be it with 50 Wellbeings for the, you know, diverse primary classroom, be it with all the other advocacy work, has definitely come as a result of things that have happened in my life. Mm-hmm. And I think had those things not happened, I may not be doing some of those things that I'm doing now.
Yeah. So in 2011, when you've gone, I'm going to take that step. Is this where Swagalicious was born, or is it a little bit?
A little bit just after, because at that moment in time, I didn't know what I was going to do. You know, you're pretty much, you're kind of going, okay, I'm now leaving a very lucrative, I was deputy head, I wanted a great salary, you know, there was no need financially for me to really take the plunge. So it was very much based on what was spiritually pulling me towards a change. So I was free, I was just self-employed, really. Yeah. There was no kind of Swagalicious or an organization or a platform of any sort. It was pretty much just, okay, let me feel the waters. So I was doing lots with like County FAs, London Plainfields Foundation, like with Middlesex, you know, volunteering. So like I said, you know, mentioned with Rachel's grassroots football club.
Yeah.
And it was a year later that I guess Swagalicious was formed.
Please tell me where that name's come from.
It came from a child, actually. It was, you know, a child came up with the name for one of their teams, and I just really liked it. And I played around with the name, and I thought, okay, you know, let me get the feelers out there to see what people think. So I just ran it as a brand. And look, you know, some people were saying, you know, not sure about it, you know. And then some people said, you know, it's quite catchy. And I thought, okay, that's what I'm going to go with. You know, if it's going to make you think, oh, I might want to find out a little bit more, then that's it, you know. And yeah, got it incorporated with Company's House, and pretty much just that then formed my base. And then I just narrowed down, let's say, you know, the work or the advocacy work that I wanted to do, which was purely going to be around equality and diversity and mental health.
Talk me through a little bit about, so over the last sort of 10 years, how that's evolved. You know, you've narrowed it down and you're going in on sort of like the equality and diversity and the mental health and well-being. What have you seen? What's changed for the good and the bad? And what, you know, and obviously there's been an impact with COVID, and we can cover that if we want to. But tell me a little bit about what's gone on with you and Swagalicious over the last 10 years.
So, I think I'd be lying to say that, you know, everything's really great, because I've got a full-time job, and I've had a full-time job for 4 years at the club. So when I was part, in essence, Swagalicious really is me, because, you know, as I'm sure there's people on this call will know that, you know, when you're going from being an employee of an organization and then venturing out on your own, you are actually on your own.
Yeah.
And unless you're in a position where you can then build that to then have a team, because look, people want to get paid, you know, as much as I had, you know, I was initially, you know, when I would run like soccer camps and things like that, you know, you're seeking volunteers because you're looking at yourself. I'm looking at myself thinking, okay, I was volunteering, and it's challenging. I find even now to get, you know, this is even when people coming into the professional game, you know, when you're thinking, okay, there's so few opportunities. The first thing people are asking about is pay. And you're just thinking, wow. You know, not saying that there aren't people who don't volunteer, because I think there are, you know, and we know that there are a lot, but there's also two sides to it, isn't there? So
absolutely.
It was difficult. So in terms of it evolving, what I recognized I had to do before I got my, so I got my full-time job in 2018. So from 2011 to 2018, it was pretty much just me. Yeah. And what I knew that I had to do was to forge partnerships and network. Mm-hmm. Because the only way for me to really go out and say to find work, but even to find connections, was pretty much to offer your services for free. Yeah. You know, and that was difficult, because you also recognize that, you know, you do need to have a certain baseline of money to be able to survive. You know,
it kind of helps, doesn't it?
Yeah. So that was hard. So it was when I narrowed it down, I stuck to my guns with, yeah, okay, this is morally what I feel was right. And then in terms of the partnerships, it was, for example, Show Racism the Red Card became my first partnership. And what helped actually is that Rachel Yankee was an ambassador for Show Racism the Red Card. And when they found out that I was working with her, and then also found out that I was a teacher, they asked me to come and meet with them. And, you know, and then we had to come, and it was pretty much a conversation. And that work I still do now, you know. And that was great, because it allowed me to not only, and we talk about a versatile skill set, that it not only allowed me to actually teach, but it was teaching with an organization that had a passion for equality and diversity, but also there was a link to football.
Yeah.
So that then, you know, I then was able to connect with Kick It Out, and then that went on to linking up with county, you know, county FAs. And it pretty much went from there. And then what I was able to do was then use, you know, you gain knowledge and skills. And then what I was able to do was then use the knowledge I had gained from the work with Show Racism the Red Card to then also be able to create my own workshops, particularly around mental health and well-being. And that's when, just prior to that, I started to think about, because I think I saw a question pop up actually about well-being in schools, that
just very quickly, if anybody has any questions, can you fire them into the chat and I will get them asked. Sorry, Manisha.
No, it's fine. So I was just to say that, and so when I started to think about where it relates to schools, I look back and I think I was already doing it when I was going through it myself. And when I was then teaching at 21, you know, that I was already thinking, okay, you know, especially around bullying, for example, that, you know, that I was very conscious about making sure that the kids felt that they were safe, that, you know, that there was an open and inclusive environment, that, you know, that they can come and talk to you and share things. And what I recognized was, look, the world of education is very different now to what it was when I was teaching I started to teach in 2001, and there were very few resources for mental health and well-being. In fact, it wasn't even spoken about. You know, it was pretty much something that was part of PSHE and circle time. That was pretty much what your well-being lesson looked like. So what I recognized was that there was a need, and there was a need because people were actually crying out for resources and help. You know, we're not experts in all these areas. And I think sometimes, you know, when you're thinking about like primary schools, you're expected to teach 11 subjects. You're not going to be an expert in 11 subjects. You're not, you know, and I think that's really, you might have a niche or become good at an area.
Yeah.
And because you, by the very nature of doing a teaching degree, you can teach, but you then have to learn the subject knowledge and do it justice, don't you? You know, to be able to deliver the information. So around the mental health and the well-being, where I started to recognize that there was a need, it was then about me gaining knowledge around not only what was this need, but how could it benefit educators, be it teachers and youth professionals. So I think the groundwork for me building up to 50 wellbeing lessons had already started, and then it just materialized during the first lockdown, purely because there was time, and there was time for me to reflect and really think. And I'd already started.
See, now you did a sensible thing there, is that you did something really positive, and lots of us went and just binge watched box sets.
Well, what I did that too, actually. I was obsessed with Ozark, and I managed to watch like the whole thing in a very little in a short space of time. But I became really obsessed with, right, as soon as I found out how to research publishers, I thought, okay, because I did Child in Mind as a prototype, which then became 50 Wellbeing Lessons. And played about with it. And it was only because a teacher friend of mine said to me, you know that this has some legs. Why don't you just do some work and look into it? And because lockdown allowed me time, and I was put on furlough from my full-time job. So, you know, off I went, looked on Google, found out that there are actually publishers that don't require a literary agent, got loads of no's. And thankfully, at least got a couple of yeses with the submission, and then pretty much went from there. And just found that, you know, it's made me feel a lot better because you know, that you're able to offer something that could potentially help others.
Did you find it quite cathartic to sort of, you know, take that knowledge that you've got and that expertise, but also sort of and then just put that into one place?
I felt like I went on a journey because some of the lessons in the book resonate with me. So there's an activity in there. So I actually, for the 50 wellbeing lessons, I actually did a whole section on like carers and adversities, because I was recognizing, and also when we think about text, the real lack of equality in text. You know, how many children can pick up a book and see children like them? You know, it's and time and time again, I would question that. And so what I wanted to be able to do was to be able to think about how diversity and well-being can almost be amalgamated, and then went through a journey. It was actually a personal journey that I feel I went on, because like I said, a lot of the activities resonate with me. There's, you know, like you've got Raj, who's a Sikh, young Sikh boy, because he's a made-up character, but really is not, because actually, if you look on BBC, he was bullied for wearing a turban, and not necessarily linked to football. Although what I've done is I've created a lesson plan, and I've got the character Raj, who wears a turban, who's bullied at his grassroots football club. No different to me. I've also got in there like Isabella, who's a young carer for her mum, who's got bipolar. What I looked at was this: is what's current. So there's a whole section on Black Lives Matter. You know, there's another section on I linked up with people who write poetry, and then my cousin, for example, who was doing art. So it was also, you know, this whole journey. There was so much in related to it where I was thinking about how I can mentor my cousin. So she'd done all the illustrations.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah, you know, and just graduated with an art degree, and how I can also think about what's current and what can really help, not just teachers, but maybe parents and also other grassroots. It's very much around grassroots. Mm. It's not geared towards a professional game at all. When I say at all, look, some coaches might pick up on it, but it was mainly for grassroots organisations.
I have put it down on my book list to read, because I read quite a lot, so I will definitely be reading it. I noticed as well on your Twitter the other day that you were not in the UK.
Well, actually, I was in the UK, but I was able to link with Denmark because, and again, you know, we talk about continuing to network and, and build connections. So the head teacher from Copenhagen International School contacted me and asked if I would do a talk for their leavers. And we set it up so it would be virtual according to the timing of when they were, their sixth formers would be at their graduation event.
Fair enough.
And it was to do with, you know, and it was really to kind of relay messages around careers and also understanding that adversities are real, mm-hmm. because some will get it. And I say this, and there are some who perhaps will not have as much empathy.
Yeah,
and that's fine. But I think this was very much around actually, you may not experience some of these things yourself, but being able to empathize with others, mm-hmm. Can still mean that you can be a change maker. Because you know, when we talk about adversities, it's not just people who are Black, White, Asian, or you know, from other community groups who are advocates and can create change. Actually, it's anyone who has empathy towards this whole subject, which, you know, like Caroline, you know, I see Caroline on here, but you know, like someone like Caroline, who's a white female, and I think about her, and I think about Alex Carroll, our academy manager, who's a white male, have so much empathy towards people with difference that that ultimately helps to create change, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Manisha, what I'm going to do is I'm going to rattle through some of the questions that have come in, and I've got a couple more as well, and then we'll try and sort of keep it to time-ish. I like to do what I'm told, Dave. Honestly, I will. So, question from John Nicholson. How have you found the support for mental health issues in education? Are they helping those in need, or is it just gestures and a tick box exercise?
So I'm not in full, because I'm not in full-time schools anymore, the day-to-day I cannot answer, but from conversations with teacher friends and the grassroots organizations that I am involved with, where I deliver and go into schools, there's still it's so much better. Okay, so there are now mentors within schools, which is great. Now, this isn't, I'm not saying that this is all schools, but generally there are mentors now, which is great. I think that I've also seen schools link up with, so if I link it to sport, and I think about football as an example, where they're linking up with the community trusts of clubs, And things like the KICS project, and you've got, you know, that there's also now wellbeing as a big part of community trusts. They then go into schools and deliver lots, you know, primary stars. There's lots of work being done within that area. So I think from that point of view, the support's getting better. But I always still question this, is that unless you've got funding that is specifically ring-fenced, or you've got something that is set in stone to say, this is what you have to use it for, and you must use it, and you must do it. Sometimes I find, particularly when I was in schools years ago, that, you know, you'd get money for PE, but the money goes into something else. So I'm always conscious, I'm still a little bit conscious about ensuring that the support does get to the children that actually need the support. But what I definitely say, it's a lot better than it was certainly when I was teaching.
Do you think that sort of going off one of the, using that question to lead into another question, do you think that a lot of the mental health well-being is better today, for example, because of what's taken place with the pandemic?
100%. Yeah. No, I do. I think that as a result of the pandemic, I think that there's almost this now, and it should have happened before.
Yes,
you shouldn't have taken this, but, you know, a realization that there's a real impact on children, young people, and also adults. And I think as a result of that, we actually have now a little bit more funding where that can be accessed. So I definitely think that as a result of the pandemic, and what I've seen is particularly from friends who are in schools, that there's a lot more work being done to support children who might have gone through certain experiences as a result of being away, you know, bereavement and that type of thing.
This is a question from Caroline. Did you have any periods of self-doubt when you were first self-employed, and how did you cope with that personally?
Oh, yeah, I did. I cried a lot and thought that I'm not going to have any money. And I said, what really upset me, and I went into teaching because I do love working with young people, but what was really upsetting me was the fact that I might fail, and that I would probably that I might have to go back in full time, but not necessarily that it's the going back in full time. It was the failure part of it, and that was really upsetting me. And what kept me going then, and what keeps me going now, because I can really relate to that question to even, and I, you know, I know this isn't about the professional game, but me being in the professional game, that it's my inner, what inspires me is my brother, because when I see him every day, I always think, could he become? And that always draws me back to what am I here to do? And why did I want to create this change? And I'm very much a big believer around, spirituality in the sense of certain things will pull you to certain things. So I was on a very good salary, and there was absolutely no reason for me to leave my job as a deputy head. But something pulled me to now being in something completely different, earning a lot less money, working double, triple the hours, and being in a very cutthroat, male-dominated environment. They're complete polar opposites. Not saying that education isn't challenging. So it was an inner strength. And I think that when you can find something that keeps you motivated and intrinsically motivated, you're there, because then you're just on a roll, and then that will just keep you. That for me, like, when that keeps me going. So when I do get, you know, times, and it still happens now, where, you know, because I'd be lying to say that it's all perfect, you know, it still exists. We know sexism exists, we know racism exists, and I'm at a great environment, but unfortunately the culture of the whole fraternity is still like that. it's I go back to what intrinsically motivates me, and that's my brother.
Okay, thank you. Manjit, it's kind of a question, I suppose. It'd be great to hear some success stories that link football to mental health and how it's helped individuals. I don't know if you've got any of those or...
Yeah, I have. So this when we did have funding with Wingate and Finchley Football Club, which is my local non-league club, what we were able to set up were some sessions for adults with mental health. So it meant people like my brother and those who had care workers were able to just come to a session with their care worker and just be able to enjoy themselves. And we had a whole range, like some, you know, there was one who, similar to my brother in the respect of, didn't talk, only spoke to voices, but, you know, but physically was able and physically was fine. So was able to connect with the sport. And other examples are where, I've been able to, you know, where people have donated. So, for example, there was a school I worked in West London where there was money donated from a grassroots organisation to go in and deliver some work with the children using activities from the book. And that's going to be no different, I guess, to like the Copenhagen International School who have donated £100, which has meant that I can then purchase 10 books, put in a little bit, and those books can then go to schools free of charge. So, you know, there are a number of success stories, but as we know, I think a lot of it just requires support, really, support and networking.
Yeah. One final question from John. What's been your toughest challenge in sport? But I'll also add a bit to that and also put and business.
The toughest challenge in sport has been it's unfortunately the sexism more than the racism. Particularly within the professional game. And I think
is that getting any better? Especially for me, it's I see the last 2 years, the women's game has just gone on leaps and bounds, like huge strides. So is it getting better, especially now that what's the name of the lady that's just been appointed to
BBC Sport?
No, the not PFA.
New chair of the FA.
Yeah.
I don't remember her name, but
it's gone.
I know who you're.
So do you think that it's trying, attempting?
Yeah, that. So I'm going to look for me. I think the change has been too slow. I think that things move too slow. And I've always said this, and Chris keeps saying this. So Chris Ramsey, we need radical change because it's taking too long, and we've got so many years that we need to almost accelerate what should have happened years and years ago for women, but for all, you know, for all protected, we're talking about all protected characteristics, you know, whether you're LGBTQ, disability, whatever you might be.
100%.
So, and I do believe it's changing, but because it's changing slowly, if you are one of the only within that, it's tough because you're almost trying to set a path, aren't you?
Yeah.
So you need, like I said, you know, I see it changing quickly purely because I'm at a club where it does change quickly.
But do you think that you see that at a club where you've got some key people and key roles that are expediting this at pace?
Yeah. Yeah. So, and because they are, I started to think that was the norm. And then I was brought back to reality by Chris that this is not the norm. And if I am to perhaps have longevity within the game, be it the professional game or the women's professional game, I also need to be more rounded in understanding the issues that exist. But it's, you need to be in a position of influence to actually influence the change. So in some respect, you know, when I think about your question, I think it's great that I'm in the environment that I'm in because there are advocates for change, without tokenism.
Yeah.
And while I'm getting mentored and guidance from those within that,
mm-hmm.
that then should hopefully put me in a better position to be in a power of influence to then create change for others and within other environments. But I do think it's getting better because if you look at the Euros, mm-hmm. John, how great is it to see there's so many more female pundits, commentators. Yeah. You know, the landscape of media is changing.
Mm-hmm.
I think definitely the landscape of playing is slowly changing. What we want for me, there's two things. One thing is around still being conscious about the fact that you still want more female coaches in the WSL and the championship and you know in the elite women's game. And I think that. In the same respect, if you've got women or men who have a passion, so you might have men, you've got men that have a passion for the women's game, but you've also got women that have a passion to want to work in the professional game, those opportunities should still be there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So one final question from me. What's next for you? What's next 2021 and beyond?
So with Stragglicious, for me at the moment, it's very much around trying to ensure that I can reach as many people as I can with 50 wellbeing lessons.
Okay.
I still continue the work with Kick It Out and Show Racism the Red Card where I can. So I'm going into, I try and make sure I can get into schools at least twice a month because that's my only day off. Those of you who know elite sport, it's 10-hour days, it's pretty much 7 days a week. And then in terms of my, you know, I'm on my A license. So if I think about, you know, the other part of me, you know, I'm on my A license at the moment. And I like to continue to learn and develop and at some stage, who knows, hopefully become I have an ambition to be assistant academy manager. Or that type, definitely that type of role. And hopefully that can help then, bring other people in, as we say, because that's the most important thing.
Yeah, agreed. And I suppose it's if you can, you're being mentored yourself, and then as you get better, you'll be able to bring others through that you can then mentor. And then, you know, that would be the next kind of steps for you as well, I would say.
Oh, definitely. And I, you know, and even now, like, because of the way in which Chris and I work, I'm in a position that I can influence change. So we've had, unfortunately, we didn't actually have any female candidates to apply for roles, but we did have people from diverse backgrounds. And we were out, you know, we didn't shy away from saying we were looking for female coaches. We were looking for female coaches to apply. Mm. You know, and unfortunately, there was one, but it was the nature of the hours that didn't work. But you know, it's what I'm glad is because of the fact that I've got leaders who are visionary and forward thinking, and I now am in a position to be able to influence some change. That for me, that's part of the course. I just think what are you in it for? That's part of the course. If that makes sense in terms of what I'm trying to say, that for me is part of. Yeah, I can influence change now. That's what I have to do.
You're there to, from everything that I've heard, from everything that I've read about you, Manisha, you're there to make a difference for positivity. I just want to say a huge thank you for taking on some of the questions that we've put across to you today. A big round of applause for Manisha Taylor.